foot of the statue. At first we thought she was going to pray, but she reaches over and takes the tube of lipstick away from Teensy, and at the last minute dots little flecks of red on the Virgin's toes where they show under her gown. She paints the Blessed Virgin's toenails red, something even the Cubans hadn't thought of. I lean over and give Niecy a kiss on the cheek. Caro kisses her other cheek. Then Teensy gives our Niecy a big, fat smack right on the lips. Back in bed, I can feel Caro's body next to mine. I hear her breathing and feel her heart beating. I smell her Caro smell that's like rice cooking and fresh-cut hay. Moonlight shines down on my friends and me. The smell of sweet olive hangs in the air like someone is breathing it out of her mouth. I look at my three friends sleeping. They still have traces of makeup on their faces, even though we tried our best to wipe it off with the sheets so Mother wouldn't see it. The Yayas are my real family. I am Queen Dancing Creek, a mighty warrior. I am of the great and royal tribe of Yayas, and no white man will ever conquer me. The Moon Lady is my mother. The next morning, we strip the beds before Mother even comes out on the porch to wake us. We have been up since sunrise when the colors of the day came alive, and we threw back our mosquito nets. Our first morning as full-fledged Yayas.
Girls, Mother is saying, y'all didn't have to remove the linens. There's no need for you to wash those sheets. Give me that bundle. I can't have your mother think I make y'all work like laundresses when you spend the night with Vivi.
We're trying to hide our sheets from her because they're covered in makeup.
Mrs. Abbott, Niecy says all smiles, please, let me take them home and wash them. I am doing it as a special penance.
What a smooth talker that Niecy can be.
Why, Denise, that is wonderful, Mother says. I only wish Vivianne would follow your example more. You are making the Blessed Virgin very happy this morning.
Niecy smiles at Mother and blinks her eyes like a true daughter of Mary, a credit to our tribe.
Well, come on in for some breakfast, Mother says. I've got fresh rust and peaches that Mr. Barnage brought for us.
We follow Mother around the porch. Just a minute, girls. I want to see if there are any new blossoms on the gardenia. And Mother rounds the porch to where the statue is.
Jesus, Mary, and Joseph!
We're right on her heels. Mother covers her mouth with one hand and makes the sign of the cross with the other. Then her body starts shaking inside her house dress.
Who could have done this? She calls out. Who in the world?
Teensy steps right up, looks straight into my mother's eyes and says,
Mrs. Abbott, this could be a miracle.
A miracle, Mother whispers, like the statue has wept or bled from her palms. Mother freezes like a statue herself for a moment. Then she begins plucking off honeysuckle blossoms, rows of Montana flowers, sweet olive branches, any bloom she can get her hands on, and showering them upon the Cuban Virgin. She runs out into the side yard and snaps off whole big magnolia branches. She snaps off the heads of tuberoses and hibiscus flowers and gathers them into her apron. I have never seen her move like this, like she is possessed. When she flies back onto the porch, she drops the blossoms at the statue's painted feet, then reaches up to shake the rows of Montana vines so that its flowers fall from the porch ceiling onto the statue's head. Never has our porch been so filled with my mother's blossoms. She has turned our front porch into an altar to the gorgeous colored Virgin. Holy Mother of Christ, she murmurs. Kneel, girls, kneel and pray. So me and Caro and Teensy and Niecy all fall to our knees with my mother, who has pulled her rosary out of her apron pocket. She is praying,
Hail, bright star of all the oceans. Hail, mother of the flowers. Shower us with the sweet fragrance of your love and compassion. You who carried in your womb him who heaven could not contain.
My girlfriends and I kneel beside my mother. We have been saved by grace from the devil alligators, from the raging storm. We alone of all have been spared. The high and mighty, almost lost but miraculously found tribe of Yayas is just wrapped up in miracles.
Chapter 9. It was drizzling the next day when Sitta and Huey Lean set out for the Quinault post office. Not raining, not showering, not sprinkling. Drizzling. If Sitta could have thought of a word for precipitation that was more passive-aggressive than drizzle, she would have used it. For the first time, she began to understand what May Sorensen meant when she said the Northwest could mildew a person's soul. She used the payphone outside the post office to check in with her agent. He reassured Sitta that she was not flushing her career down the toilet by taking this time away, and that the world had not ended in the last week. Waiting for her in the general delivery basket was a card from Connor made from a recycled watercolor sketch of one of his set designs. On the back he'd written, "Dear Sitta, the bed is too big now that you're away. I can't sleep when I have more than the 1/16th of the mattress you leave me to sprawl on. Finish the designs for the second act, and the Seattle team is good. There are about 1 million trumpet lilies coming up in our temporary backyard here. Did you find the box I put in the car? Give Governor Huey Lean a belly rub for me. I love you. Connor." Back at the cabin, Sitta dried Huey Lean's long ears, which resembled curly flaps. She made herself a cup of tea and changed into dry, warm socks. Sorting through the CDs she'd brought, she once again chose Ricky Lee Jones singing the old standards from Vivi's era. She walked to the windows and looked out at the lake, humming along with "Spring Can Really Hang You Up the Most." Picking up a postcard with a picture of a gigantic geoduck, Sitta drew a set of wings on the giant clam so that the unseemly northwest shellfish resembled a penis about to take flight. On the back, she wrote to Connor. "Baby cakes, don't exaggerate. I always allow you at least 1/4 of any bed we've ever slept in. I miss you, too. Yes, Mama's box is in hand. Well, not in hand. Let's just say it's here. And there. And everywhere. More on that later. I love you. Sitta." After she stamped Connor's card, she reached for the scrapbook. She puzzled at 4 narrow strips of leather that had been tied together with a piece of twine. A 1941 penny was slipped into a slot on each band of leather. Leaning her head back and staring at the ceiling, Sitta let out a muffled little laugh. 4 penny loafer cutouts. She could picture her mother and the 3 other Yayas wearing out their loafers, then ritualistically carving the penny slots out of them. Was this a fad that was popular with all the kids back then, or something peculiar to the Yayas? On the same page was a photo of the 4 girlfriends taken on the side porch of the Abbott home on Compton Street from the same era as the penny loafers. After glancing at the photo for a moment, Sitta put the album down and went into the kitchen. She checked all the drawers before returning to the big room. There, in the second drawer of an old pie chest that held playing cards, a Monopoly game, and a collection of moon snails, she found what she was looking for. Returning to the scrapbook, Sitta blew on the magnifying glass, then wiped it clean with her sweatshirt and began to examine the photograph. She'd looked at it before, but she wanted to really study it. In the photograph, a rose of Montana vine wound up and across a porch railing so thick with blossoms that the light must have glowed pink. On an oversized rattan sofa with wide, curved arms and chintz-covered cushions lay Vivi, Nisi, Caro, and Teensy, 2 by 2, head to foot, with their legs in such a tangle that Sitta could not tell whose painted toenails were whose. Vivi wore a striped halter top and shorts, and her hair was pulled up off her neck, with little blonde tendrils falling loose in the moist heat. A wrought iron table was to the side of the sofa and held a black rotary fan. Four tall tea glasses sat on the floor with long spoons in them. Sitta studied every detail. Who had taken this picture? What was happening just outside the frame? What happened the moment before this image had been captured? Setting the magnifying glass aside for a moment, Sitta relaxed her eyes so that the photo was only vaguely in focus. An afternoon of iced tea and idleness. Those yayas aren't going anywhere. They're lying low on the side porch shaded by live oaks. The Germans are about to reach Stalingrad, and the gas chambers are heating up. But the yayas are still in high school, and the life of the porch surrounds them. They are lazy together. This is comfort. This is joy. Just look at these four. Not one wears a watch. This porch time is not planned, not penciled into a day runner. Those porch girls had no idea they were going to sprawl on that couch until the weight of their adolescent bodies sank down into the pillows. They have no idea when they will get up off that couch. They have no plans for what will happen next. They only know their bodies touching as they try to keep cool. They only know that the coolest spot they can find is in front of that rotary fan. I want to lay up like that, to float unstructured, without ambition or anxiety. I want to inhabit my life like a porch. People took porches and porch time for granted back then. Everybody had porches. They were nothing special. An outdoor room halfway between the world of the street and the world of the home. If the porch wrapped around the house as the Abbots did, there were different worlds on the front, side, and back porch. If you were laid up on the side porch the way the yayas were in the picture, you were private, comfortably cloistered. The side porch, that's where the yayas went if their hair was in pin curls, when they didn't want to wave and chat to passers-by. This is where they sighed. This is where they dreamed. This is where they lay for hours, contemplating their navels, sweating, dozing, swatting flies, trading secrets, there on the porch in a hot, humid girl soup. And in the evening when the sun went down, the fireflies would light up over by the camellias, and that little nimbus of light would lull the yayas even deeper into porch reveries. Reveries that would linger in their bodies even as they aged. When people encountered them years later with babies on their hips, or still later, with hands shaking from some deep-six sadness nobody could name, there was an aura about them. You could not put your finger on it, but you knew these women shared secret lagoons of knowledge. Secret codes and lore and lingo stretching back into that fluid time before air conditioning dried up the rich, heavy humidity that used to hang over the porches of Louisiana, drenching cotton blouses, beads of sweat tickling the skin, slowing people down so the world entered them in an unhurried way, a thick stew of life that seeped into the very blood of people, so that eccentric, languid thoughts simmered inside. Thoughts that would not come again after porches were enclosed, after the climate was controlled, after all windows were shut tight and the sounds of the neighborhood were drowned out by the noise of the television set. Visden. That's what the yayas called their impromptu get-togethers when Sitta was a girl. The four Walker kids crammed into the T-Bird with Vivi, bombing into town to Caro's or Teensy's or Niecy's, pulling into the driveway, madly blowing the horn, shouting out, "Y'all better be home!" Then a batch of Bloody Marys appeared, and cream cheese with pica-peppa, and crackers, a gallon of lemonade and Oreos for the kids, Sarah Vaughan on the stereo, and a party. no planning, no calls in advance. On such outings, Sidda might dress up in one of the Yaya's trousseau peignoirs and let Vivi coach her in reckless, delicious, Isadora Duncan-inspired interpretive dancing. Waving a yardstick magic wand with a tinfoil star, Sidda might gyrate wildly across whomever's porch they happened to be on. What heaven it was when Vivi's light shined on her. Afternoon would pass into evening and evening into night, and before you knew it, the day was gone, and Vivi and the kids were weaving their way back home to Pecan Grove, windows rolled down to a cool breeze. "Ain't we got fun, little buddies?" she'd call out to the kids. And they'd call back, "Oh, yes, Mama, we do got fun." Sidda picked the magnifying glass back up and studied her mother's eyes in the photograph. When did things go bad? What created the paradox of Vivi full of light, Vivi full of dark? For every such scene of magic, there were an equal number of terrifying cocktail hours when Vivi's bourbon and branch water took her far away from her children, although she might never leave the house. On those evenings, when Vivi stepped out of her bedroom to freshen her drink, she would say, "Get away from me. I cannot stand to look at you." Sidda learned to stay on the ball. She learned to walk the tightrope. She perfected the ability to walk into a room and instantly divine each person's mood, need, desire. She developed the capacity to take the temperature of a scene, a character, a conversation, a single gesture, and to gauge just what was needed and when and how much. Vivi swung wide in her waltzes with angels, in her jousting with demons, and her daughter learned to choreograph drama from these fluctuations. Her daughter learned the subtle, wobbly, inspired, emotional patois that a good theater director needs to speak fluently in her art. But Sidda was tired of being vigilant, alert, sharp. She longed for porch friendship, for the sticky, hot sensation of familiar female legs thrown over hers in companionship. She pined for the girlness of it all, the unplanned, improvisational laziness. She wanted to soak the words time management out of her lexicon. She wanted to hand over, to yield, to let herself float down into the uncharted, beautiful, fertile, musky swamp of life where creativity and eroticism and deep intelligence dwell. As Sidda set down the magnifying glass and closed the book of divine secrets, something caught her eye. An adult and an adolescent eagle took off from the uppermost perch of an old cedar near the cabin. As the adult swept from her spot in the tree, her wings beat so loudly it almost sounded amplified. When Sidda heard the clamor, her head tilted to one side. Those eagles, like angels, don't distinguish between work and play. To them, it is all one and the same. Chapter 10. From May's cabin, Sidda struck out in the rain along the lake trail, then deep into the rainforest, where the canopy of trees was so thick she could not feel the rain. The darkness and quietness both comforted her and frightened her. She felt like a child might feel in a dim, silent cathedral. When she arrived at the Quinault post office, she found a postal worker behind the counter watching soap operas on a tiny television. The woman glanced up at Sidda. "You general delivery?" she asked. "Yes, Sidda Walker, please. Anything for me?" Trying not to take her eyes off the TV, the woman reached over to a shelf and pulled down a small package. "From Louisiana," the postal worker said. "Certified." "Goody, goody," Sidda said, then felt slightly embarrassed. "Forest Service says we got sun coming this week," postal worker said as she handed the package to Sidda. Sidda said, "That would be lovely, wouldn't it?" "One thing you got enough of in a rainforest, and that's moisture." "Oh, well," Sidda said, turning to the door. "Makes for smooth complexions." That's what I tell my girlfriends, the woman said. This comment struck Sitta, and she turned back to look at the woman once more before leaving. My girlfriends, said so casually. Sitta almost felt a twinge of envy. Standing under the covered walkway in front of the little post office, Sitta examined the package. A certified package from Mrs. George E. Ogden, or as she was better known to Sitta, Niecy. Sitta wanted to rip the package open right away, but decided to wait until she was back at the cabin. She tucked it under her Gore-Tex parka and walked back to the cabin. As soon as she'd entered the cabin and removed her wet parka, Sitta opened the package. She had not expected to hear from any of the Yayas. Not one of them had contacted her since the New York Times piece had come out. Written on engraved stationery, blue with a gold rim, with Niecy's monogram on the top, was the following letter.
August 16, 1993. Dear Sitta Lee, I am sending you all my best wishes for your upcoming wedding, whenever it takes place. You just take your time, honey. I'm just so sorry y'all aren't going to tie the knot down here so I can see you and meet your Mr. Wright and see your dress and all. Many congratulations on your big theater hit. I am so sorry George and I couldn't get up to see it. Frank and his wife and the other petite yayas who saw it just raved, and they love seeing you. Even though I couldn't come, I want you to know that my brood reported back. I am so proud, Sitta. I always knew you had greatness. Honey, I personally think it is marvelous that you are even interested in our lives as yayas. I told Liza, Joni, and Rose, and they all thought it was quaint. My daughters have very little interest in the past, but then they did not choose a life in the theater either. They all send kisses, by the way. Melissa said again how much she loved seeing you last year when she flew to New York with Stephen for that convention. I swear he is one of the nicest husbands she has ever had. I hope the Yaya Rabilia your mama sent is helpful. The New York Times upset your mother terribly. I'm sure you know that. Newspapers have exaggerated since the beginning of time, but still, that's no excuse. Your mother gave me full permission to send you anything I thought you might be interested in, so I'm sending you some of her letters that I've saved. I have started a novena to St. Francis Patrizzi, patron saint of reconciliation, for you and your mama, Sitta Lee. We all love you, honey, and are praying for you all the time. Hugs and kisses, Niecy. P.S. I swore to your mama that I would make you promise to return these letters to her when you return the scrapbook. I know you'll take good care of them. Niecy's letters were in a Ziploc bag, and as Sitta opened it, she gave a little prayer that her intentions be true. She didn't pray that they be pure. That was asking too much. Handwritten in Vivi's girlish hand on sheets of unlined writing paper was the following account.
December 12, 1939, 11:15 in the morning, on the Southern Crescent, heading to Atlanta. Dear Niecy, gosh, Sugaroo, you can't imagine how much we miss you. I'm not kidding either. The yayas just aren't the same without you along. You asked me to write you about every little thing, and that is just what I'm going to do. I'll save everything, and we can paste it into my Divine Secrets album when we get home. Even though your mama wouldn't let you come because she thinks Ginger isn't a proper chaperone, I am going to make you feel like you are right here with us. We are all mad at your mama. After all, we are 13 years old. Juliet Capulet was only 14, for heaven's sake. And Ginger is so, too, a real chaperone, even though she is a maid. Oh, I love being on a train, girl. When we pulled out from Thornton waving to you, I was so sad to leave you behind. Once the Southern Crescent got going, oh, it was just wonderful. You just feel like you can go anywhere when you're on a train. Like Thornton isn't the only place anymore, but just one of a whole lot of towns all over the world.
This is my first time on a train without Mama or Papa, and I look at everything, at the backs of the houses, and the ladies out there hanging clothes on the line, and the little bitty towns we pass. You just wonder and wonder what the people are doing in those places. I'd like to get off the train at one of these little old stops and just go into the town and tell them I was somebody else and try out living a whole other life. You could be anybody you wanted, and no one would ever know. Honey, we had four seats all to ourselves facing each other. You were the sweetest thing in the world to make us these cookies. We have got two shoeboxes of fried chicken and biscuits that Ginger made. There is a whole car just for colored people, and that's where Ginger is. She was worried as can be that she had to leave us. She even tried to talk the porter into letting us stay because we are her responsibility. But he told her, I wish I could, but it be against the law, and the boss will have my hide. Then Ginger said, yeah, well, Miss Delia gonna have my hide if anything happened to these here white girls. I have never gone on a trip with a colored person, so I didn't know they had a separate car so they wouldn't break the law. Anyway, that is where Ginger is, so we are on our own. It's like we don't even have any kind of chaperone at all. You should see people look at Ginger. They can't believe a colored woman with red hair, just like everybody in Thornton. Let me tell you, sweet patootie, we have got a deluxe compartment. It has two pull-down berths, which make four beds altogether, and that is what breaks our hearts because there is an empty bunk which would have been yours, Countess Singing Cloud. Tonight, before we go to sleep, we are going to fold down the covers and pretend you are there. Teensy brought the latest modern screen with her, so we're reading all about Gone with the Wind. Miss Yankee Vivian Leigh's picture is all over it, which just breaks our hearts. We have still not forgiven them for not casting Tallulah. Vivian Leigh is not only not a Southerner, she isn't even an American. Oh, all those hats. They have pictures of Scarlett's outfits and hats in modern screen, and it is enough to make you wet your pants just waiting to see them for real on the screen. We are so, so, so lucky to go to the premiere. Teensy's Aunt Louise and Uncle James in Atlanta are just rich as sin. He was a friend of Hoover's, and he just about owns the Coca-Cola bottling company. In Atlanta, he just runs the show. Teensy's father asked her to have us up there. My secret dream is to meet Margaret Mitchell. Don't tell anybody, but it is my plan to get her autograph at the ball. I will just slip away and find her and tell her how much I love her book and ask for her autograph. What do you think of that? Countess, I have to go now because Duchess and Princess Jaybird want me to play cards with them. They all say kiss, 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 and we love you to death and miss you every single minute. I'll write you again later today. Kiss, 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 Vivian. Tingling with excitement, Sitta put down the letter and walked into the big room. She picked up the scrapbook and began to search through it. She felt sure she'd seen something about Atlanta somewhere among her mother's souvenirs. She flipped through page after page until she found what she was looking for. It was a clipping from the Atlanta Journal dated December 15, 1939. The headline read, Junior League's Ball by Far Most Brilliant in History of Atlanta. The article read, Social brilliance without compare in Atlanta's romantic history wrote a glorious chapter of accomplishment for the Junior League's Gone with the Wind costume ball at City Auditorium Thursday night. New highs were recorded for elegance of setting, quality of program, and importance of those in attendance. It was an epochal occasion from any standpoint. One not remotely approximated by anything that had ever happened before. Clark Gable, Vivian Leigh, Olivia de Havilland, Claudette Colbert, Carol Lombard, and dozens of governors, capitalists, socialites from Maine to California, and magnates whose genius has created a mighty industry in motion pictures, statesmen and writers and actors, all richly garbed, were serenaded with spirituals by a group of Negroes in plantation costume from the Ebenezer Baptist Church. 50 members of the Junior League then promenaded through the curtain, one by one, each attired in a gorgeous party frock of Scarlett O'Hara's day.
The piece went on from there, but Sita's eye was drawn to a paragraph further on in the article. It was circled and had an arrow pointed to it. In the margin were the handwritten words, "Guess Who?" The circled paragraph read,
"Dancing on a floor with around 3,000 other people, the feminine guests found their hoop skirts were apt to be up in the back or out on the side. One young girl in a navy bengaline and green taffeta hoop skirt, getting up to dance, tried to pass in front of a couple in the dress circle, and her skirt, much to her confusion, went entirely over the head of the person sitting in the seat in front of her."
Sita laughed out loud. Hungrily, she went back to her mother's letters.
"Later, 11 o'clock at night, in our berth. Nisio, I am in my top berth with Caro and Teensy up here with me. The curtains are open, and we can see fields passing by with moonlight shining down on them. We have on our nightgowns, and we've got your cookies right up here with us. And as I promised, we folded down the covers on your bed just like you were going to lay your sweet little head on the pillow. Oh, Nisi, I wish you were here. You should be here."
"You won't believe what happened only about a half hour ago. We were singing and getting loud, but no louder than usual, and then out of nowhere there was a knock on our door. We didn't know who in the world it was, and we had on our nightgowns already, and we started giggling, and then Carol whispered that it was Clark Gable, and we started rolling around on the bunk, kissing the pillows, moaning, 'Rat, oh, Rat!' And then the knock came again, and we just almost wet our pants. So Caro jumped down from the bunk and cracked open the door and said, 'What do you want?' And me and Teensy were leaning down, peeking, and we saw the conductor. Now I thought he is going to tell us we're making too much noise. But all he said was, 'Just checking to see if you young ladies are doing all right. Your father asked me to keep an eye out for you.' And we all told him we were doing just fine, but then Teensy said, 'Do you think we could please get some cold milk to go with our cookies?' You know Teensy, she will ask for anything, anywhere. And the conductor told us he'd see what he could do. And Caro climbed back up in the bunk, and she said since she was the one to answer the door, that I had to pretend to be Rhett. 'Kiss me, Rat,' she said, and I gave her a kiss, and she said, 'Rat, oh, Rat,' and then I put my finger back up above my lip the way we do to pretend we have Clark Gable's mustache, and then there was another knock on the door, and we all thought it was the conductor again, and so I climbed down and opened the door. It was a colored porter with 3 glasses of milk on a platter for us. I thanked him, and he asked if we wanted our shoes polished. We all said, 'Yes, thank you.' And I got our shoes and handed them to him. Then he said in a whisper, 'Ginger want to know if y'all be doing all right. She say run 2 cars down if you in trouble and she take care of you.' We were all surprised that he knew Ginger, but Ginger gets around. You know she does. I thanked him and he said, 'My name is Mobley if y'all need anything.' And so Mobley has just taken off with our shoes, and he better bring them back, or we'll have to go sock-footed to the diner in the morning. Riding a train is a wonderful thing. I've decided that I just want to live on a train. Oh, you should just see the way the world looks as we roll along. I don't know exactly where we are right now. Just somewhere in the countryside, I guess, heading up to the gate city of the South. We all say goodnight, sleep tight, and don't let the bedbugs bite. Kiss, 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 Vivi."
December 13th, 1939, Atlanta, Georgia, 3 o'clock in the afternoon.
"Dear, dear, Niecy Cakes. We pulled into the Atlanta Depot at 9:17 this morning. The station is huge. You could fit maybe 3 of our Thornton Depot into this one and still have room left for a small dance party. Teensy's Aunt Louise met us at the station. She was wearing a big fur coat with a matching hat and muff, and she had Teensy's cousin James Jr. alongside of her. She greeted us all very politely, but right off the bat, I could tell she was a snob. She is a nicer snob than her son, but still a snob. That James Jr. is a snob without even the decency to try and hide it. He said something ugly about my luggage before we even got out of the station, and when he saw Ginger, he acted like it was illegal that she was not wearing a maid's uniform. Teensy told him that not all maids wore uniforms in Thornton, and he looked at her, his very own cousin, like she had head lice. Well, Niecy, I have decided to overlook the way they act because we are their guests. Let me tell you, girl, this whole city is on fire with excitement. You can feel it crackling through the air. There are movie displays in every single store window, and it's like all of Atlanta is one giant movie advertisement. I hear that Miss Mitchell has been staying inside her apartment ever since October because the swirl is just too much for her. She's just been having to rest and take aspirin every half hour. I can imagine how she feels after all she has been through to write the best book in the world. And then to have the movie opening and all. Oh, I wish I could get to know Miss Mitchell. I would give anything in the world. I feel like I already do know her, but I want to know her better. Well, when we got to Aunt Louise's house, we all had to pick our jaws up off the sidewalk. It is a mansion. Teensy says Genevieve secretly calls it the Coca-Cola Palace. I mean, it's like nothing we have in Thornton. Big circular drive and a porch that is so dressy you feel like you're in a dining room. And inside, oh, Niecy, it's like something out of the movies. They are so rich that all their colored help wears crisp uniforms and acts English. Not at all like at home, where we play cards in the kitchen with Ginger or Shirley or whoever. The very minute we got here, Aunt Louise said to one of their maids, "Go and outfit this maid from Louisiana right away." It was like she didn't know Ginger's name, although I had introduced them when we got off the train. Aunt Louise looked at Ginger's clothes like they were full of fleas and bugs or something, which you know isn't true because Delia would not have it. Well, then the next time we saw Ginger, she was tugging at this black starched uniform and white ruffled apron, and she had this little maid's cap on her head. I teased her and said, "Ginger, I'm going to take a picture of you so everyone at home can see you all dressed up." And she acted real funny, like she didn't know me. Delia would just fall over laughing at the sight of Ginger in that Frenchy uniform. The three of us are staying in a gorgeous big room here in the mansion with its own huge bathroom and a fireplace and a bay window looking out over the backyard. Our antebellum hoop dresses had already been hung in the armoire. I just can't wait to wear my navy bangaline. This is all real different from at home, Niecy. It is way fancier than Teensy's house. There are tiny little bars of soap in the shape of tennis rackets in a silver dish in the bathroom. That is how rich they are. Carol and I are sleeping in the big bed, and Teensy's going to take the day bed that has a jade satin comforter on it. The butler, or whatever he is, brought our bags up here, and that's where I am now, writing this all down to you so you'll feel like you're here with us. I like having to write everything down, because then I know I will remember it. There is so much to see and do and take in that my head is spinning. Oh, well. We are in Rome, and I reckon we'll do like the Romans. More later. Kiss, 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 kiss. Vivi. Later, 10:30 at night. Niecy girl. We had this formal sit-down dinner and met Uncle James. Finger bowls and silver napkin rings with their high hat monograms on them. That awful James Jr. sneered at me the whole meal. I don't even see how that boy could be related to Teensy and Jack. Teensy has taken off all her clothes, and you should see her. She's stretched out on the bed with her legs crossed and her head thrown back, and she's saying, "Peel me a grape, Beulah." You know how she is. She made all three of us climb into that big clawfoot bathtub and bathe together when we got upstairs. She dumped the whole bottle of French bath salts into the water. The whole bottle. We just laid up in that tub and soaked ourselves silly. I know I shouldn't be telling you this because your face is probably all red by now, Niecy Pooh Bear. You are so much more modest than we are, but we love you anyway. Kiss, hug, kiss. Vivi. P.S. Our beds were turned down for us when we came upstairs. It made me miss Mother. She always turns my pillow over to the cool side when she comes in to say goodnight. P.P.S. Gee whiz, I almost forgot to tell you. In the Atlanta Constitution tonight, they describe what Miss Mitchell is going to wear to the premiere. A pink tulle dress with layers and layers over pink crepe over a tight-fitting bodice with a sweetheart neckline. I can't send you the paper because Aunt Louise is keeping it for her Gone with the Wind scrapbook, but I copied this down for you before I gave her back the paper. Rose-colored camellias, those flowers so redolent of the Old South, will form her floral adornment, and tiny silver slippers will peek beneath the folds of the bouffant skirt. Since I plan to meet Miss Mitchell personally, I will tell you more about her outfit after I see it for myself. December 15th, 1939, 2 o'clock in the morning. Dear Niecy, girl, 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 we have just gotten home after the most exciting day that I have ever had in my life. Ginger was waiting for us, all upset because she didn't get to come with us for everything, and almost in tears because she thinks she's not doing her job as chaperone. We have hardly laid eyes on Ginger since we got to the Coca-Cola Palace. She says Delia is going to kill her when we all get home. I said, "Ginger, I don't even want to think about going home. Now, will you please go downstairs and make me some coffee milk because I have to stay awake to write Miss Niecy." So here I am writing you from the big bed where Caro is sound asleep and Teensy is snoring as usual from her bed. I am always the last one to go to sleep, no matter where I am. But, honey, I have got to tell you everything. First of all, this morning, we had breakfast. And you know that Aunt Louise was already dressed up in a gorgeous antebellum dress. Yes, right there at the breakfast table. And that little weasel, James Jr., had on a tattered Civil War uniform that Aunt Louise had got her hands on. Uncle James had already gone off to Coca-Cola, and I don't know what he was wearing. All I know is that Aunt Louise revealed that her dress came from the actual movie. A whole bunch of her friends from the Junior League were extras for the bizarre scene, remember, from the book, and got to be in the picture. Can you imagine? That goon, James Jr., took off with some of his 12-year-old goon friends, and Aunt Louise said she was spending the day going to the events with her friends before they had to go over and check the municipal auditorium where the ball was. So that meant that Ginger and one of Aunt Louise's maids came with us when William, the driver, took us out and about. Girl, there were already people on the streets of Atlanta out walking around in their Civil War finery and antebellum dresses. We had on the car radio, and they were reporting everything like it was FDR himself coming to town. A whole bunch of stars were arriving at the train station, including Claudette Colbert, but we missed a lot of news because at 10:15, we were at the corner of Whitehall and Alabama streets for the big lamp lighting ceremony. I never knew it before, but that very lamppost managed to remain standing after Sherman's siege of Atlanta. And that very lamppost was relit to show that the Confederate spirit has not died.
The three of us just cried and cried, thinking about the Confederacy. And then the governor gave everyone the rest of the day off because Premier Day had been declared a state holiday. So then, old William drives us to Peachtree Street, and he finds us a good place, and we sit on the roof of the car to watch the parade. Oh, it was so crowded. I mean, people were 8 and 10 deep. And then the parade started. Niecy, there must have been 50 or 60 cars with stars sitting in the back of convertibles looking like royalty. Clark Gable himself was there. Honey, I'm not kidding. I saw him with my own 2 eyes. And he is just as wonderful as I thought he would be. Carol Lombard was with him, and they waved and smiled at us. And I swear to you, Niecy, he looked right at me. Teensy and Carol are still trying to act like this did not happen, but they are just jealous. I'm telling you the truth. Clark Gable looked right at me and smiled. But back to the parade. I saw more stars and ritzy cars than you ever imagined existed. You just forget you ever heard of a depression when you see something like this. After the parade was over, William took back streets to get us to the Georgian Terrace Hotel. At the hotel, would you believe that there were governors from 5 southern states up there giving speeches? We had to wait until all those old men were through, and then Clark Gable himself got up. Everyone was yelling and screaming and clapping and giving the rebel yell. So the three of us did our rebel yell, you know how we do, and I gave some of my famous whistles. You would have just fainted from all the hoorah. We were just exhausted by the time we got back home, and we had some fruitcake and cokes in our room and took a nap. We pretended that we were the Southern Belles at 12 Oaks during their nap scene. We said, Ginger, why don't you find a fan and fan us like at 12 Oaks? And that Ginger said, it's December. Y'all don't need no fan. Hush up and go to sleep. Teensy whispered, Delia lets Ginger get away with murder. But Ginger heard her. She could hear a cat tiptoe across a carpet. And Ginger said, Miss Teensy, you better nod off or you gonna find out what murder mean. We didn't get to sleep for long because Aunt Louisa's maid came in and woke us up to start getting ready for the ball. Aunt Louisa's dressmaker was here, and we had to try on our antebellum dresses for her because Aunt Louise wanted to see if they needed any adjustments. My navy bengaline and green taffeta is the cat's pajamas, as you know. But I tell you, those hoop skirts are hard to get around in. Just turning around, I knocked a fussy little knick-knack off a prissy table in the Coca-Cola Palace. Thank goodness it didn't break. And so we were all dressed to the nines in our Civil War get-ups, and William drove us over in the Packard, and another car carried Aunt Louise and Uncle James to City Auditorium for the costume ball, Dixie's greatest social function. That skunk, James Jr., came with us and drove us crazy. He is only a year or so younger than us, but he acts like he is a big, fat baby. I started making faces at him before he had a chance to make faces at me. He told Teensy she looked stupid in her white taffeta ruffles, and so she pretended to wipe a booger on his goofy-looking Confederate uniform. We started laughing so hard that I busted some little hooks in the back of my dress. I don't see how Scarlett and them ever managed a good laugh in these things. Well, I forgot about everything when we got to the ball. There were thousands of people lined up in a little park in front of the auditorium. Uncle James said they were the people who didn't have tickets and that they should have stayed away like Mayor Hartsfield requested. But they were standing out there in the cold, looking like the folks who live at Ollie Trot's Trailer Paradise at home, with bad teeth and all. When the police gave them orders to move back, they did. We just walked right by them, Niecy. Aunt Louise tried to make us hurry, but we all had trouble walking in those hoop skirts. You might look like a lady in those things, but you get nowhere fast, let me tell you. Oh, my God. Inside was all done up like the old South. The stars sat up in their own boxes by themselves. Gable the king and Vivian Lee wearing this black velvet gown with 84,000 ermine tails on the sleeves. And Carol Lombard with her hair under a black snood. And Olivia de Havilland arrived late and she had to be lifted up into her box. Tinksy and Carol and I fought over the opera glasses just to see it all. Oh, all the stars were there. But not Prissy, or Pork, or Big Sam, or even Mammy. They couldn't come to Georgia because they are colored. Aunt Louise told us exactly what all the stars' outfits were made of. And she could also tell you whether the outfits were designed by the guy who designed the movie costumes or not. Aunt Louise knows all these kinds of things because Gone with the Wind has been her personal project for 2 whole years. She is actually friends with the actress who plays India Wilkes in the movie because that lady is from Atlanta herself. Aunt Louise says that she doesn't think her friend is all that good of an actress, but at least she represents the South. Finally, I asked Aunt Louise if she had any idea where Miss Mitchell was. And do you know that Aunt Louise, the witch, looked right at me and said, "Don't worry yourself over that ungrateful hack, Vivi. She has not shown up." I said, "What? What do you mean Miss Mitchell hasn't shown up? This party is hers. She is as big a star as Vivian Lee." But Aunt Louise just gave this little laugh like she knew better. All the way back home and getting out of our costumes, all I could think of was Miss Mitchell. I did pop the hooks, and I also tore my costume under the arms and sweated a lot. I guess you are not supposed to move or breathe when you wear those outfits. I can't get Miss Mitchell off my mind. I asked Carol and Teensy why. Why didn't she come? Why in the world didn't she show up? Teensy said, maybe she was sick. But I think there is something more to this. A great writer like Miss Mitchell has a reason for the things she does. I'm going to find out why if it kills me. So, that is our day, Countess Singing Cloud, and every single word is true, and when we get home, we will act things out for you, like the way Gable and Lombard turned and talked to each other while they walked arm in arm, and how the actor that plays Scarlet's father kind of dances like your Uncle Collie. But for now, it's sleepy time. Scarletly yours, Vivian. December 15th, 3 o'clock in the afternoon. Dear Denisio, Carol and Teensy asked me this morning, "Vivi Cakes, what all are you writing to Niecy?" And I said, "I'm recording all our divine secrets for when it is time to write our memoirs." Because Niecy, I just know that somehow everything the four of us do is important. I believe that years from now, people are going to want to know about us. Well, we all slept real late, especially me, who was a real lazy head after staying up all night writing to you. When I woke up, Aunt Louise was already back from the press club luncheon, and she was stirred up to beat the band. We all went downstairs where she was on the phone to about 100 of her friends. We tried not to listen in, but really, we had no choice. Because we had to stand near the phone because it was cold in the house and the heating duct by the telephone was the warmest. And also because we were looking for a button that Carol said she lost right around in that area. Haha, just kidding. I had to listen in case she was talking about Miss Mitchell. Well, Aunt Louise kept on giving us looks, but we just kept ignoring her and listening. Just before it sounded like she was about to finish a conversation, we ran into the kitchen and started looking in the icebox for something to eat. The maid had left us some roast beef sandwiches and a cheese and fruit platter, and we were opening some Cokes when Aunt Louise walked in. She said, "Well, I don't suppose I need to tell you what I'm so upset about." We acted like we didn't know what in the world she was talking about, like we had not listened to her rant and rave over the telephone to everybody in Atlanta. Teensy acted all concerned and said, "Auntie Lou, what is wrong?" And then Aunt Louise reached into the back of the pantry, pulled out a cracker tin, and lifted a bottle of brandy out. She poured herself a glass and said, "Do not ever call me Lou. My name is Louise. I believe I've made that clear in the past, Amy." "Well," Ah Teensy smiled at her aunt and said, "Please, ma'am, do not call me Amy. My name is Teensy." "That Teensy is so sly." Aunt Louise ignored Teensy and sat down at the kitchen table and told us that Miss Mitchell, according to her, had just slapped the Junior League right in the face by not showing up last night for the costume ball, which was sponsored by them. After all they had done for her and her book, and it was all because back in the early 20s, when Miss Mitchell was a debutante, she went to a charity ball and just went wild and performed this wild and risque, apache dance and shocked all the Atlanta Junior League ladies so horribly that there was nothing they could do but punish her by never inviting her to be a member of the Junior League. So Miss Mitchell was trying to get back at them by not showing up at the ball, even though she was a guest of honor. "What is an apache dance?" I asked. "I just had to know. I am a reporter here, Niecy. I need details." "I see no reason to expose you girls to the lurid details," she said, which made me want to know all the more. "Was she naked like a savage?" Teensy asked. "Well, no. Margaret was not exactly unclothed," Aunt Louise said, putting a hand to her head. "Well then," Carol said, "what was all the big fuss about?" "I can only tell you that Miss Margaret Mitchell performed what she later described as an Indian mating dance. The whole thing was utterly unacceptable for any lady to do. No matter how firmly ensconced her family was in this town, they could not protect her from the consequences of such an act. The Junior League has its standards, something I hope you girls will never forget." "Oh, no, ma'am, we won't forget," Carol said, then turned her back to Aunt Louise and made like she was going to throw up. Then we all got the giggles, and Aunt Louise told us to run on upstairs and amuse ourselves. "Well, Niecy, I think it is marvelous that Miss Mitchell tweaked their noses, don't you? Still, I am sick that I did not get to meet her last night, and I am going to do everything I can to meet her tonight at the premiere. I have got to close now because the three of us are going for a walk to look at the Christmas decorations in the neighborhood before we come back and get ready for the premiere. Kiss, 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 kiss. V.A. Later, 10:45 p.m., Dear Countess Singing Cloud. I don't know how to put it all into words, but I will try. We have just come from the premiere of the greatest movie ever made. I take back every single thing I ever said against Vivian Leigh. I love her. I adore her. Vivian Leigh is Scarlet. I went in thinking I would not ever let myself like her, that I would never forgive them for not casting our Tallulah darling in the best role ever written. But all of that is gone. The minute I saw Miss Leigh there on the steps of the porch at Tara with the Tarleton twins at her side, and she said, "Melanie Wilkes, that goody goody." Well, I was a goner. Oh, gee, honey, I don't know how to tell you about the movie. You are just going to have to see it for yourself. I didn't know that it could ever, ever be so romantic. Oh, when they kiss. Oh, when she pretends she doesn't know which way the hat goes. Oh, when he picks her up and carries her up the stairs. He was so much nicer than in the book when he does that. Oh, when she gets the idea to take down the curtains and make that dress, Vivian Leigh's right eyebrow shoots up, and you can just see the thoughts shooting through her head. And all the times the yah-yahs have said fiddle-dee-dee, and how we said it made us sick to think that an English person was going to be the one to say those words. We were wrong, Niecy. We were wrong, 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 and I don't mind admitting it.
I want to live in this movie, Niecy. This is the kind of drama I was born for. Let me tell you, as much as I can get down, I am still so excited and so tired from crying and clapping. But don't worry, it is worth it to get everything down. I forgot to tell you about the theater. The Hollywood people made it so the front of the Lowe's Grand looks exactly like the front of Tara. And there, somehow, was a whole lawn they grew across Peachtree Street for all the stars to walk on. They walked on this new grass the whole way. Mr. Gable was so chivalrous, Niecy. He said exactly what I would have wanted him to say. He said that the night wasn't his night, but that the night belonged to Miss Mitchell. Ah, that really showed me what Mr. Gable is made of. That made me fall in love with him to the point that I will just never get over it. He was so handsome, oh girl. He had on this black overcoat and a white scarf wrapped around his neck, and Miss Lombard was wearing this gold lamé gown that just about blinded your eyes out. Then, the moment I have been waiting for all my life, a limousine, long as a city block, pulled up, and Miss Mitchell got out. Oh, Niecy, she is so teensy. She makes our teensy look like a giant. And she gave a short little speech, mainly thanking everybody, and then she walked into the theater. To tell you the truth, I think she was nervous. I wanted to run up to her and get her to sign her name for me, but it was not the thing to do, even if I could have gotten through the crowd. Just seeing her was a thrill. So, we went into the theater, which was packed to the gills. You could smell the men's hair tonics and the ladies' perfumes and hear the shiny dresses rustling. Carol and Teensy and I all held hands. I guess I was holding my breath, too, because when the curtains opened, I felt like I was gonna pop. Oh, these huge titles crossed the screen like the wind was blowing them, and there was this music that had me crying even before the credits stopped rolling. And after that, I don't think I breathed for hours until Scarlett was out in the field with that turnip, swearing she would never go hungry again as God was her witness. And the music got louder, and pretty soon the intermission lights came up, and everybody was clapping like crazy, and the movie was only half over. At intermission, the three of us just held hands in the lobby and could hardly talk. We had trouble getting down the refreshments that Uncle James handed us because we were still back at Tara. How could we drink punch when Scarlett was starving? And then all the sadness. Oh, Niecy, it just broke my heart into a million pieces all over the floor of the Lowe's Theater. I cried and cried, and so did Teensy and Carol. We used up all our hankies, and all I could think of was how much I am like Scarlett, never having a handkerchief when I need one. Honey, why did she treat him so bad? Why? Rhett loved her. Couldn't she see that? Why couldn't she see that? I am never, never going to let something like that happen to me. When I meet my own Rhett, I am going to love him back if it just kills me. Oh, Niecy, I just can't write anymore. I'm so tired, and I start crying all over again when I start thinking about it all. I'm going to sleep now, after the most exciting day in my life. I was wrong. I had thought yesterday was the most exciting day in my life, but today